Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in African Studies. My name is Esperanza Brizuela Garcia, one of the hosts for this channel. Today, we will be talking to Dr. Jeffrey Allman about his book, Living with Nkrumahism, Nation, State, and Pan-Africanism in Ghana, published in 2017 by Ohio University Press as part of their New African History series. Dr. Allman is an assistant professor of history at Smith College. He specializes in African political, social, and cultural history. Dr. Allman, welcome to the podcast.
Right, thank you.
I wonder if you could just begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
I'm from central Nebraska, where I grew up, and I went to, I did my undergraduate at the University of Nebraska, where I studied history with minors in philosophy and political science. And it's at the University of Nebraska where I became interested in African history by working with two historians there, primarily Walter Rucker, who's now at Rutgers University, and James LeSueur, who's still at the University of Nebraska chairing the history department. And it's through them that I became really interested in African history and primarily the history of decolonization.
And how did you come to write about Nkrumah in Living with Nkrumahism?
Again, the project began in, I guess, its broadest form at the University of Nebraska, while working with Professors LeSueur and Rucker, who they introduced me to the study of decolonization, and primarily the intellectual history of decolonization, as I began writing a thesis on sort of comparing the intellectual lives of Nkrumah, Frantz Fanon, and W.B. Du Bois. And it's sort of through their introduction of Nkrumah to me that I became interested in sort of how he negotiated, like, his ideas of African unity within sort of the changing context of decolonization, or the changing world that of the post World War II era that sort of culminated with Ghana's decolonization. And I just continued with this at the University of Illinois, where I did my graduate degree, initially trying to imagine a project that could combine my interest with sort of all three of these figures, but primarily Fanon and Nkrumah. And I originally imagined, and what ultimately turned out to be a failed dissertation project, initial failed dissertation project, looking at the ways, or looking at sort of these groups of Ghanaians who became particularly interested in the Algerian Revolution and sort of Algerian decolonization. And I imagine this as a project sort of to transcend the way that the Sahara divides histories, African histories, in many ways, primarily looking at sort of the transnational connections that and networks that developed between Algeria and Ghana, and Nkrumah's Ghana. That project didn't pan out. And so what I ended up doing is trying to figure out how, one, why that didn't work out, which has very sort of strong connections to sort of the history of the Ghanaian archive, the sort of politics of archiving across empires. And then I was sort of in Ghana trying to figure out what to do next, and became particularly interested in sort of these stories that people kept telling about how life was under Nkrumah, which in many ways conflicted with sort of this overarching narrative that you get when you read histories of sort of the Nkrumah years in Ghana in the 1950s and 1960s, and primarily like the political science research that took place between the 50s and the 70s that sort of emphasized like narratives that Ghanaians weren't overly interested in Nkrumah's thoughts. So they didn't they just sort of coped with it, or they rejected it. What I found was people were actively engaging it, and I became interested in how they were engaging it, and in what ways and in what places. So that sort of emerged as my dissertation, initially a dissertation topic, and that sort of grew into this book.
I was very interested in how you, you know, you talk about the archive, the sort of the Ghanaian archive and the sort of like that interface between the colonial archive and then the sort of like the transition into the post-colonial archive, and how much that sort of determined both the structure and the questions that you addressed in the book, and how in some instances you find it, you found it very limiting, but at the same time, you know, it gave you opportunities. So can you talk a little bit about, as you're going through this, through the process of how you're going to structure the book, and how this happened, you know, how the nature of the archive itself led to the particular structure that you chose?
Yeah, just in general, like when you're thinking about what decolonization means in terms of archives, decolonization sort of in its most like fundamental definition is sort of an end of colonial rule, which signifies an end to or a shift between sort of government controls. And we're thinking about archives, particular in government archives, there's a transition taking place between who's administering the archive, who's deciding what gets collected and what doesn't get collected, where things are going. And so what this meant for Ghana, or previously sort of the Gold Coast, was sort of in the colonial era, you had an archive within the Gold Coast itself that collected a vast array, and an incredibly rich array of documents detailing sort of the operations of the colonial state, petitions from Gold Coasters to the state, arguing for a whole array of things, challenging governmental like land policies, maybe cases agriculture, maybe petitioning for pay raises for civil service, sort of these types of things. So that's taking place within the colony itself, but sort of more broadly, you also have a sort of a larger archival umbrella that's taking place in London, sort of collecting a whole array of documents from sort of throughout the empire, sort of throughout Africa, and then the empire more broadly, that sort of creates and sort of sustains the ability to sort of look at different types of networks that the empire itself is in many ways unwittingly building and maintaining. In some cases, that's broken up by decolonization. Particularly as new nation states come into being and they establish their own archival traditions, these networks aren't as clearly visible in the archives, or at least not in the same way. And so you're coping with that a bit in the Ghanaian situation. And then more broadly, as the Ghanaian government encounters a variety of challenges to sort of within self-rule, economic challenges, political challenges, archiving in many cases sort of falls by the wayside. And so within the Ghanaian archive, by the time you get past around 1960-ish, the archive becomes much more sporadically maintained. And so you don't have the same sort of rich archival narrative or in the 60s onwards as you do from the colonial period. And so you're forced into making do with a much more, or an archive with many more holes in it. And then it becomes exacerbated primarily after Nkrumah's overthrown, when in many cases it appears that the archive was ransacked by the by the new military government and the materials that we have are what we know that they're just a tiny portion of what existed prior to the 1966 coup.
Yeah, I know that. I would imagine that, you know, it's one of those situations in which you kind of have a sense of what you could have and you don't. So it is, as a writer, I imagine you're constantly thinking about, you're identifying the gaps and then figuring out where to fill those gaps. And I imagine that's also what took you to these other different archives outside of the UK to try to outside of the, you know, of Ghana and the United Kingdom. So where you could find possibly some means to get to those voices that could fill those, the gaps that you were identifying as you were researching.
Yeah. One of the things that I try to tell my students, because here at Smith College, they have this amazing resource, the Sophia Smith Collection on U.S. History, which is one of the richest U.S. women's history collections in the world. And so they have this idea of an archive that sort of this beautiful space where they go and work in, and everything sort of seems at their fingertips. And then I show them pictures of the Ghanaian archive and also or primarily the Padmore Research Library's archival collections. And then I also reiterate to them that when we're talking about Ghanaian history in Ghana in the 1960s, like this is the iconic post-colonial African state where you have people throughout the world looking to Accra to understand the direction of not only Africa, but the decolonizing world as a whole. So it's this massively iconic place within the international imagination in the 1960s. And when we think about what the archive has today for this period, it's a couple thousand file folders within the National Archive itself to work with in order to try to reconstruct this history. And then so they compare that to what they see sort of right next to them in the library.
Yeah. Well, that's a good lesson for them. Well, let's get into the book. You start the book by setting somehow not just the ideological scene, you know, so the world of Kwame Nkrumah, what are the, and you mentioned this is a world that sort of comes together in a, from many different places and in a multifaceted and sort of multi-layered way. So can you give us just a quick, a brief sort of summary of how the thinking of Kwame Nkrumah came to be as you detailed it in this chapter?
Yeah, so what I tried to do sort of in this first chapter of the book is to understand sort of the broader context that he lived in that was likely influencing his decision making later in life, but really just sort of shaping the way that he, as well as his contemporaries, sort of imagined the world. And I do so by sort of initially situating him, who was born in 1909, sort of he was born sort of in this era that was sort of in many ways the not sort of the formal beginnings of colonial rule, but the beginnings of when colonial rule sort of became sort of consolidated in people's minds. And so we have this sort of idea of colonialism that I think in many ways he would be sympathetic to, where the history of colonialism, as it's often told or reflected on, is something that seems like a very long period in African history. And there are specific reasons why it seems that way, even though really the colonial rule, formal colonial rule in the Gold Coast was approximately 40 years old by the time he was born. And there's the reasons for this are connections to the slave trade, sort of the ways that you have histories of the slave trade blend into histories of colonial role in sort of popular narratives. And then also on top of that, the way this is sort of propagated by colonial thinkers, as well as European thinkers themselves, and cultivating like this idea of Africa as being backward and sort of needing colonization, and needing colonization as a way to end the slave trade within Africa, well, the transatlantic slave trade, then slave trade within Africa itself. And so you have this narrative of colonialism that makes colonialism appear like it's this longer phenomenon, when it is actually something that was really being consolidated by the time he was born. And so what I see with Nkrumah's sort of thinking and sort of what he's reacting to later in his early life is sort of the blending of sort of these narratives, where you have him and others sort of reacting to the so this sort of changing political environment, and sort of reacting against sort of the liberal and progressive narrative that sort of comes out of colonial rule, and sort of showing that what sort of gets propagated as colonialism being this sort of process, supposedly this process of betterment for Africans, this sort of civilization process, you have sort of these pushbacks showing it as an economic process designed to indebt Africa primarily. And so what I try to do in the chapter is sort of situate Nkrumah as part of sort of this whole range of thinkers at the time who are challenging sort of this progressive narrative of colonialism and sort of emphasizing that colonial rule is sort of this, it's a mechanism to sort of tie Europe or tie Africa to Europe and to primarily sort of European capitalism. So Nkrumah, as I see it in this chapter, is part of sort of a cohort of people that include Nehru in India, Padmore in the Caribbean in the UK, and sort of this whole group of people who are really sort of challenging sort of this liberal narrative of colonial rule that sort of by the end of the chapter sort of transitions to what sort of previously was calls for colonial reform to demands for immediate self-rule.
One thing that I find very interesting about this chapter in particular, but I think that comes, I mean, through the book, is sort of like the question of the engagement of Nkrumah with sort of like the intellectual history of in the Gold Coast. I mean, like you said, he talks a lot about, I mean, he engages with the particular group of intellectuals who have sort of debated or discussed, you know, Kaseli Hayford and, you know, Kubi Naseki and people like this, who to some extent have engaged with, you know, Pan-Africanism or have had this awareness, you know, of Africa as a continent and liberation, et cetera, et cetera. But that at the same time have like this foot in this other sort of historical tradition, like what generally it's called like the cultural nationalists. Of the Gold Coast, and I've always been kind of amazed at the sort of like at the cut, you know. It's like Nkrumah really does not want to see back. It's like I've always been intrigued by this relationship of Nkrumah with the history of the Gold Coast that goes beyond colonialism. I was wondering if you have thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, what he's doing, so he's doing a couple of different things sort of at this time. And the way I try to set this up is by reading through his Independence Day, sort of the famous line from his speech where he declares sort of the independence of Ghana is meaningless without the independence of the rest of the continent, sort of to paraphrase it. And that's often just sort of looked at as sort of a call for African unity itself, but I see it as being read on sort of multiple historical levels. Sort of one level is connecting back to the Pan-Africanism of the sort of the Du Boisian Pan-African tradition of the sort of post-World War II era up to about 1930, and then sort of reinvigorating itself with the Manchester Pan-African Conference in 1945, which is often sort of portrayed as sort of this largely diasporic Pan-African tradition, primarily in the Du Bois eras, or the Du Bois years. So I see it as he's connecting on one level that sort of history of Pan-Africanism through this phrase. And then in addition, like you talked about, sort of the Gold Coast cultural nationalist tradition, anti-colonial tradition, that in many ways is sort of this Pan-West Africanism of the early 20th century. And I think he's very much, like you said, sort of hearkening back to that and combining that within these statements. And then, as I tried to articulate earlier, on another level, he's connecting it to sort of this international anti-colonialism that develops in the early 20th century and trying to connect Ghana's early 20th century history to that sort of global history as well.
Yeah, no, this is an interesting sort of like genealogy of how his thought starts to crystallize. And I found it also very illuminating how you use the term radical anti-colonialism, you know, that, to characterize his way of thinking or what comes out of that, as opposed to what could be much more like simplistically look at nationalism. I actually was interested in how little use you have for the word nationalism throughout the book and how the tendency is to use much more the notion of either decolonization or anti-colonialism, which seems much more accurate. Was that deliberate or am I imagining this?
I mean, I think it's connected to the challenges that I had in defining Nkrumahism itself and what Nkrumahism and then under that sort of nationalism and Pan-Africanism and sort of socialism and anti-colonialism, sort of how they all weave together. And so what I found with sort of the term nationalism is it carries so much baggage, I guess, that it's very difficult to use without that baggage. And so it's so I found it much easier to and much more useful and important to use terms like Pan-Africanism or Nkrumahism itself sort of to specify the changing sort of political environment and sort of the environment of sort of political ideals at the time. I think it was kind of deliberate, but I think it's also sort of me reflecting on it sort of after writing the book.
No, that's, your answer in terms of like, it sort of reflects exactly how one needs to be thoughtful about those terms, you know, in terms of what they carry with them and in terms of how well or not do they communicate what we're trying to communicate. So moving on into the next couple of chapters, you talk about in your second chapter about basically that period of negotiation, like the 50s when Nkrumah is sort of negotiating with the British, sort of the terms of independence and how this transition is going to work. and how is this is the period where you see sort of like the vision of Nkrumah actually sort of taking shape. What is his vision? And the other part that I wanted you to sort of touch upon as you talk about this chapter is that, so how, you know, you're very clear that one of the things that you want to do in the book is to historicize this process, you know, not to sort of define Nkrumahism as it was in the 50s and then just see how, you know, leave it there and then follow it through, but like how to show how it evolved in response to very specific conditions. So this is the beginning of the story. So how do you see it taking shape in response to what conditions in this particular, you know, in this early period?
Yeah, so what I see, how I see it taking shape is in terms of you have Nkrumah's first government coming into power and in 1951, following a general election. And sort of over the course of from 1951 to 1957, when Ghana becomes independent, you have this challenge for Nkrumah and his party, the Convention People's Party, to sort of solidify their position as a government in an era when they aren't independent, or the country isn't independent, and they do have sort of these British officials sort of looking over their shoulder continuously throughout the period. So they're trying to establish themselves as a radical yet respectable government in many ways. And they're trying to showcase Ghana for an international audience. And you do have this is sort of the beginnings of the period where you have people sort of coming into the then Gold Coast and trying to sort of make sense of it. So most famously, Richard Wright is traveling throughout sort of parts of the Gold Coast in the early 50s and sort of narrating what he sees going on with sort of this, what he imagines should be going on. And his book comes out, I want to say in 1954, if I remember correctly, which doesn't necessarily paint the most romantic picture of Ghana or the Gold Coast at the time, and sort of Nkrumah and the Convention People's Party. So you have them negotiating that aspect of it. And then within sort of Gold Coast politics itself, you have groups who are arguing for sort of their own sort of political positions and sort of understandings of who and what they belong to that conflicts with sort of the CPP's vision of a potential sort of unified Ghana or unified nation. And so they're projecting their own sort of ideas of nation that in many ways conflict with the CPP at the time. And the way that the CPP tries to make sense of it is by essentially delegitimizing these alternative movements or these alternative nationalisms, for what it's worth, and going all in on this idea of a unified Ghana. And in doing so, beginning sort of this process of closing sort of arenas for political debate or the ways in which sort of respectable political debate could take place, and sort of closing those off. And this becomes sort of, at least what I argue, the initial stages of sort of creating a particular sort of orthodoxy of Nkrumahism that the state tries to adhere to. It changes over time, as you mentioned, in many ways, but this is sort of during this period, sort of the first moment that the state begins to sort of articulate ideas of Nkrumahism, sort of Nkrumah's thought that that they begin to try to change into an orthodoxy.
And then in the next couple of chapters, you know, 3 and 4, where you talk about, you know, the creation or the sort of the constitution of what is a Ghanaian citizen, you know, the debate about what constitutes a Ghanaian citizen, or like you said, more largely the post-colonial citizen. And then in chapter 4, when you talk about the importance of work, you know, and workers, you basically see the implementation of that vision, you know, and how that vision starts to sort of historically take shape in the forms of this, all these different projects. Can you tell us a little bit about this, about the youth projects and then sort of like the policy towards workers?
Yeah. So, those chapters, I think you're right, should be sort of read together because they're very much sort of speaking to each other. So the Nkrumah government was particularly interested in youth as youth and workers, because much like Fanon, Nkrumah sort of saw decolonization as sort of this process of reinvention, right? So Fanon argues that decolonization sort of is a veritable creation of new men, I think is the quote. And Nkrumah wasn't far off from that, and sort of how he understood what the process of decolonization was supposed to do. It wasn't supposed to be sort of this transfer of power, or even a sort of a transfer of power that ultimately leads in sort of a radical African unity that that he becomes particularly famous for arguing. Rather, he saw decolonization as a process that was supposed to transform the individual and then transform society sort of writ large. And youth played into that in very particular ways because the youth were in many ways seen as a blank slate. If you could get to the youth and sort of teach them sort of how to be proper citizens, proper socialists, proper activists for the sort of political cause of the state, you were able to imagine a path forward that sort of creates a foundation that will adhere to the values and sort of promote the values of the state, and that won't be corrupted by sort of pre-existing historical linkages, whether it's to what they sort of saw as what they termed as tribalism, but was sort of connections to sort of ethnic forms of belonging, class connections, sort of familial bond. They'd be able to be separated from this, and sort of their connections would be to the state. And so what the government did quite early on, what they were discussing even before independence, was ways in which to inculcate Ghana's young people and these in these values of the state. And they did so by creating a handful of very prominent state institutions. The most prominent ones would be the Ghana Young Pioneers and the Builders Brigade, which was later renamed the Workers Brigade. And in these institutions, Ghanaian children and young men and young women were taught that they were to be disciplined, that they were to be ordered. They were they were taught sort of the values of the state. They were taught what socialism was, why it was important, how it was supposed to disrupt the sort of the capitalist system and ultimately liberate them, liberate the country, and liberate Africa sort of from the vestiges of colonial rule. And similarly, in terms of workers, the governments initially saw, or the CPP initially saw them as a sort of a built-in base of support. It didn't always pan out for the CPP, but they quite early on, they tried to mobilize the workers for their cause and then to essentially stage a coup of the Ghanaian workers movement and try to control the movement. And then in addition to that, emphasize to the workers an idea of work that was to separate them from viewing work as a means of like individual accumulation and individual sort of wealth generation to one that focused on the productivity of the state itself and sort of transforming the way that workers looked at the work that they were doing and emphasizing sort of this idea that, as sort of one magazine article I quote, states, sort of working for the state is working for ourselves. And so in both of these instances, whether it's youth or whether it's workers, the CPP focused on these groups as a way to sort of view sort of the decolonization process as a process of sort of creating a specific type of citizen that was supposed to sort of lead the country forward.
And as you move into your last chapter, which was probably one of the most difficult to write, negotiation, Krumahism, belonging, uncertainty, and the Pan-African one-party state. Here's where you use, I imagine, we made the most use of interviews, and you try to sort of make sense, as you say, of all these different experiences of how people actually experienced all these projects and these sort of new directives from the state. You don't have to make sense of the whole thing, but could you give us a couple of stories or a couple of examples of that you think are particularly telling of basically how diverse the responses and the lived experiences of people were under during this period?
Yeah, so what I was trying to do in that chapter particularly is, you said, sort of understand the diversity of ways in which people engaged with the state. And one of the things that I encountered in writing the book, but also talking about it with people who were sort of non-specialists, was this idea that trying to understand sort of African politics and sort of what it was like to live under an African regime that sort of over the course of the early 60s, primarily beginning around 1960, maybe 61-ish, was becoming increasingly authoritarian and for an array of reasons that were both internal and external, connected to fears of subversion from the outside, as well as assassination attempts on Nkrumah's life. The state or this period is becoming increasingly authoritarian and shutting off avenues for active political engagement. And what I noticed when I was talking to people about sort of this period and sort of what it was, people like in the United States who sort of have the reflections on like what life must have been like, they tended to think that it was, people were sort of purely closed down and were actively trying to disengage in every way possible from the state, or that they were sort of blind adherents to sort of state ideology and or state actions, and sort of whether they accept it or not, they're sort of going through the motions. And what I found in both the archive and as well as talking to people is that people had an array of reactions to the state. And for some people, they they did try to actively engage engage the state to enhance their way of life. It could be in terms of petitioning for raises for certain civil servants. It could be looking for sort of new forms of belonging, whether it's sort of connections to the party or connecting to this particular group, whether they're like in the Young Pioneers, and sort of the bonds that were created by being part of sort of this organization that where you have sort of a cohort of what were then children sort of coming of age together. They could be connecting to the state for various reasons. But what I also notice is they're often doing it and sort of making these gestures and using the language of Nkrumahism to promote their particular interests at the time and connecting to the state. Other people recognized that there were real challenges to connecting to the state. There were real threats in terms of connecting to the state, and this could play out in terms of if things didn't go the right way, they or family members could be detained. They could be reported on by others. So there are real challenges and real threats to them by connecting to the state. But for some, it was worthwhile. And others did actively disengage from the state as much as possible and tried to make a life independent of the state. And so what I was trying to do in the chapter as a whole is sort of show the range of engagement and disengagement and to sort of articulate as clear as possible the ways that people sort of made their way through this period of time in Ghanaian history. And it's a period of time that it often gets elided over in many studies of sort of Nkrumah's years. It uncomfortably fits between sort of the triumph of independence and then the coup and so you get a general sort of narrative that that gets created that sort of presents sort of this period in the early 1960s as necessarily leading to the coup. But from the perspective of the people living at the time, the Nkrumah state was something that seemed like it could be around for at least the foreseeable future. And so there was no idea that a coup was going to happen. And so they're trying to make their way through this period.
I was interested in sort of like the initial project or like the instinct that you were following was kind of going against this sort of teleological tendency that we have when we think about, well, I mean, in general, when we do history, that, you know, it's like we know the end and now so let's just backtrack our way from this and figure out how we ended here, almost thinking that that the end was inevitable, like you say. And I was wondering if you could sort of reflect a little bit about why do you think it's important to go against that tendency? I mean, this is something I've thought a lot about in terms of, you know, if it's history here to explain to us how we got to the point where we are right now, why do we necessarily want to look at sort of like those avenues that didn't pan out or the things that didn't work out? We have this tension between history as explaining, you know, as it connects to the present, as opposed to history as it was, you know, and I sometimes even with my students, the question always is like, history as it was is important, not always necessarily for the same reasons, but it is. So how would you make that argument?
I think that, I mean, what I try to do, emphasize with my students is that like history, at least as I see it, is a way of understanding differing perspectives that took place in the past. And then the constraints that people had as they negotiated their way through specific contexts. And what I think is particularly important is like to understand and sort of to break away from sort of this, these theological narratives of like what necessarily happened is like when we think about something like decolonization, if we sort of go with this narrative of decolonization that sort of begins with the end of the Second World War, sort of creation of the United Nations, and then sort of Indian independence, and then sort of Ghanaian independence, and then sort of all the independence of the Year of Africa, and so the creation of this idea of decolonization as a process that sort of to create nation states, we necessarily extricate from our histories the whole variety of differing ideas and sort of competition of ideas and conflicts and sort of processes of imagining more broadly that that people went through and put forward at this time. And this could be from people like Nkrumah, Fanon, Sekou Touré, Nasser, sort of these sort of big name heads of states slash thinkers, Nehru as well. Sort of, it could be sort of how their ideas and sort of how they're trying to articulate it. But then it could, then at the same time, you have a whole range of many more people sort of on the ground interpreting that, but also articulating their own ideas for and hopes and ambitions for what the what their futures are going to look like or can look like. And they're going through their own sort of processes of imagining that that are in conversation and that are challenging those of sort of their political leaders. But this moment from 1945 to the mid 60s is one sort of pure imagination, but it's an imagination that comes into conflict with external processes, whether it's the Cold War, external conflicts, whether it's the Cold War, sort of challenges from and sort of continual intervention from former colonial powers. They run into sort of this sort of global environment that begins to constrain these possibilities. And then within their particular countries, they run into sort of local challenges as well, such as they articulated in the second chapter of the book with the CPP coming into conflict with an Asante Nationalist Party, parties, Muslim Association Party, and sort of a variety of sort of different sort of subnational parties. So they come into conflict with sort of local politics that, again, could further constrain their possibilities. And so when we're thinking of sort of what histories look like and what the possibilities for understanding sort of these specific moments outside of a teleological vision, what we're doing is we're recreating the ways and sort of the ways in which people are living through moments, negotiating moments in in rich ways that don't necessarily conform to the world as we have it now, but that are challenging it. But when we think about sort of these constraints as well, we're understanding what was the possibilities that were closed off at the time.
Yeah, that was very nicely said. Yep, I'll borrow it for my students, definitely. we're beginning to think that I've taken quite a bit of your time. Before we go, could you just let us know what are you working on? You have any projects that you're working on right now? What's next for you?
So what I'm primarily working on right now is I'm writing a book for IB Taurus's Modern History series, which is essentially a history of Ghana from approximately 1850 to the present, that's emphasizing the variety of ways in which Ghanaians and Gold Coasters and Ghanaians imagined various forms of belonging sort of over this long time period. What types of connections do they make inside and outside of Ghana, and sort of why are those important in sort of shaping the way that Ghanaians think about what it means to be Ghanaian sort of over this sort of 150, 170 year period. So that's what I'm primarily working on at the moment.
Good. Well, thank you so much for talking to us today. It was very, very illuminating, and thank you so much for making the time. Is there anything else you would like to add to, you know, your projects or what you would like the people to get out of the book?
No, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Well, thank you so much. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.